From London, BBC Caribbean Report.
Trade inequality for the Caribbean could become a reality after a key US Senate vote this afternoon. Guyana's next constitutional hurdle looms large, and why the Caribbean shouting to be heard at a major climate change conference. I'm Debbie Ransom and this is BBC Caribbean Report. After a major setback in the US Senate last week, a trade bill designed to give a big boost to Caribbean economies looks set to be voted on and to become law. The bill seeks to reduce or eliminate duties on a range of goods produced in the region. Leslie Goff reports.
Political wrangling over domestic issues such as gun control and the minimum wage almost resulted in the crucial Caribbean and Central American Relief and Stabilization Bill being dropped from the U.S. Senate agenda last week. But the bill, attached to a similar bill for Africa, was saved at the last minute on Tuesday when senators, who'd spent the weekend horse trading to remove obstacles to the bill, voted to move forward with a speedy debate and vote this week. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a key supporter of the trade bill, said the U.S. had narrowly avoided becoming an international laughingstock.
We have risen to a moment which was ominously in doubt. A moment in trade that would be shameful. And let us now proceed in the good heart and great expectation.
One of the main opponents of the bill, Senator Fritz Hollins of South Carolina, bitter after failing to block the bill last week, said it would rob American workers of jobs and do little for the Caribbean or Africa.
We've been through this exercise, how we're all going to put our arms together and hug and love and help our neighbors and everything else of that kind. Fine business with me if it really would work that way. It hadn't worked that way and not about to work that way in sub-Saharan the CBI.
Despite the best efforts of its opponents, the Caribbean and Central American Relief and Stabilization Bill has remained on the Senate agenda. Barring any late political wrangling between Democrats and Republicans, the trade bill should have easy passage into law. The BBC Caribbean Report, this is Leslie Goff in New York.
In the final countdown towards a new-look European banana trade deal, Caribbean diplomats are pulling out all the stops to get an export regime their farmers can live with. The Caribbean hopes a rewritten banana trade arrangement can be in place before the next World Trade Round talks at month-end in Seattle, Washington. Jamaica's marketing organization says it believes that the key to a breakthrough on this deal would be the latest American promises not to challenge the new arrangements at the World Trade Organization. Jamco's executive director is Junior Lodge. I asked him whether his organization shares the optimism of CARICOM leaders that America will not challenge the latest European reworking of the banana import deal.
We are sanguine after numerous discussions with the Americans, in particular USTR, that they share our concerns on the validity of a two-TRQ regime being maintained. Of course, we are very much aware of the difficulties that they have, which relate to the services side, namely how access to commercial companies to those TRQs is managed.
Now, the Caribbean says it hopes an agreement can be reached before the WTO next trade round talks in Seattle at the end of the month. But what about this suggestion that the proposal might not actually be compatible with WTO rules?
From my understanding, WTO rule compatibility is really a question of if all participating member states agree on a measure, then it becomes WTO rules. So in other words, once we continue the thrust of securing a negotiated settlement where all interests of the competing parties can be accommodated, I think that the question of WTO compatibility is rather secondary.
But could we get to the stage where Europe's happy with the deal, the ACP's happy with the deal, America is not going to challenge the deal, but the WTO could still say, hey, this is not in line with our judgment, our past judgments?
No, I suspect that we shouldn't preoccupy ourselves with such a concern for the simple reason that the way the Secretariat functions, the Secretariat can only be called into action as requested by a member state. So if no member state voices an objection, then the Secretariat remains silent on the matter.
What would the proposed tariff rate quota arrangement actually mean for the average banana farmer in the Caribbean?
Well, in the first place, it means a continued ability to secure access to the EU market. market, the only market that is available to Caribbean growers. What is clear, having said that, is that the prices that are going to be returned to growers during next year, assuming that we have a 2TRQ regime, are going to be depressed given the fact that more fruit is coming into the market and, in fact, that Caribbean growers are going to be exposed to even greater competition from Latin American quarters. And, of course, it is very well known that Latin American fruit is far more competitively priced than Caribbean fruit. So clearly we are facing a scenario where we cannot avoid increased competition.
JAMCO's Executive Director, Junior Lodge. Guyana's political peace process has crossed one key hurdle, but observers are now questioning whether other parts of constitutional reform can be worked through in time. The Parliamentary Select Committee, given the task of refining the report of the Constitution Reform Commission, has handed in its recommendations to the Speaker of the National Assembly. Constitutional reform was one key part of the CARICOM-brokered peace accord between Guyana's two main political parties. Although the committee met its end of October deadline, Colin Smith looks at the new concerns that some of the real issues still remain to be dealt with.
The Parliamentary Select Committee was expected to resolve a number of key issues which were unsettled at the end of the previous stage of this constitution reform process. This has not happened. The committee's report shows that once again, the two main political parties have failed to reach agreement on some crucial matters. These will now have to be debated and resolved by the National Assembly. Dr. Rupert Rupnarang, leader of the Working People's Alliance and a member of the Select Committee, told BBC Caribbean Report that he was disappointed and concerned.
It was a disappointment to me in the Commission that we never really grappled with what seemed to me the really central issues, which have to do with the political system under which we are living. And we in the Select Committee did not go near that because, of course, the Constitutional Reform Commission itself did not put to us a recommendation that indicated there was any willingness to alter the system. But yes, I do believe a lot of work has been left for the National Assembly, and that is going to be very difficult to organize because it is my view that if you cannot reach an agreement in the confines of a select committee, it is going to be more difficult to reach agreement on the floor, on the open floor of the House.
The reform of the Constitution is one of the terms of a peace accord signed by the two major political parties. That accord brought to an end widespread social unrest which erupted after disputed general elections almost 2 years ago. In that accord, the ruling party also agreed to cut short its term by 2 years and hold fresh elections, now due in 14 months' time. While accusing the ruling party of deliberately delaying the reform process, the main opposition has been insisting that the next election must be held on the agreed date. Some say, however, this is an unnecessary and impossible race against time. Colin Smith in Georgetown, Guyana for BBC Caribbean Report.
Sir Alistair McIntyre has stepped down as the United Nations representative dealing with the Guyana and Venezuela border dispute. His successor is to be Barbadian diplomat Oliver Jackman. Mr. Jackman is a judge on the Inter-American Human Rights Court and a former ambassador to the European Union. Guyana's Foreign Affairs Ministry said today it accepted the new UN appointment. The announcement comes at a time when Venezuela's new government has increased comments repeating the country's century-old claim to the Essequibo region. An Organization of American States report criticizing the Dominican Republic's policy on Haitian immigration has stirred up major controversy in Santo Domingo. Ken Richards reports.
The OAS Inter-American Commission on Human Rights report urges the Dominican Republic to give Haitian migrants work and residency papers. It also recommends that their children born there be nationalized, but those kinds of suggestions are not playing well in the DOMREP. The suggestion there is that the organization should instead channel its efforts into a movement to attract international help for Haiti. President Leonel Fernandez has himself entered the debate to defend his government's policy on Haitian immigrants. He's denying that the practice of repatriating these immigrants is inhumane. The Dominican leader has threatened to lodge an official protest with the Organization of American States. The OAS has been very critical of the expulsion last week of thousands of children born in the DOMREP to Haitian nationals. And the head of a women's Haitian immigrant group, Sonia Pierre, is accusing the government of violating the Spanish-speaking country's constitution by refusing to give the children education, health care and residency papers. Various sector groups are, however, rejecting these criticisms, countering that the DOMREP has done more than its fair share of trying to deal with the Haitian problem.
Ken Richards, you're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. Caribbean countries are fighting to have their voices heard at the United Nations Climate Change Conference taking place in Bonn, Germany. Over 100 nations are meeting to come up with a detailed document on dealing with global warming. Rob Broomby is the BBC correspondent at the meeting. I asked him whether industrialised nations are giving proper attention this time around to cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, I think there's an awful lot of lip service being given to that end. No one stood up and said what's happening is a good thing. Obviously, everybody wants to tackle global warming. The question is how it's done and how it's paid for. The flexibility mechanisms were a way of reducing the cost to richer countries. But many people in the poorer countries, particularly in the island communities, in the Pacific and also in the Bahamas and the Caribbean, people feel very let down that the industrialized world is not making more progress to tackle this. Just a short while ago, the Minister of Finance of Trinidad and Tobago was outlining the situation as it affects his country. Increasing tropical cyclones, rising sea levels, increased intensity of the cyclones, a fairly drastic and dramatic scenario he was laying out if the international community doesn't come to agreement soon.
You mentioned the Trinidadian delegate. How much of a case is being made by Caribbean and other nations whose countries could lose whole parts of coastal land if sea levels do rise?
Well, they tend to have the attention of the media rather than the attention of the other delegates. In some ways, they are what it's all about. There are communities around the world which will disappear completely if sea levels rise as a result of global warming, but they don't have the clout, they don't have the power, and they don't really have the ability to influence these discussions. But they find their way onto the airwaves. I've been speaking to a number of people from the Pacific today, and they feel very, very strongly that this opportunity is being squandered, that not enough is being done. They set the ball rolling. They feel having drawn attention to their particular plight, and now they're being largely ignored.
You're there on the ground. Do you get a sense that these smaller countries really can make their voices heard, where the major powers are fighting each other on major issues and not in any mood for compromise?
Well, they do their best and they make their views known whenever they can. But as I say, they're spending more time perhaps talking to us than other delegates simply because we try and focus as broadcasters and journalists on the people who suffer from these things. The international community at the moment is bogged down in this conference in very, very detailed discussions about exactly how these flexibility mechanisms will work. And until they come to agreement, there's little hope for those people at the sharp end.
Rob Broomby in Bonn. A group of Jamaicans calling themselves the Citizens for Civil Society is trying to organise a demonstration in Kingston against some leading political figures. At the top of their hit list are opposition leader Edward Siaga, Security Minister K.D. Knight and Finance Minister Omar Davies. They've targeted these politicians because of the country's rising crime rate and the continuing economic problems. Karen Weir reports from Kingston.
The group, a movement led by Jamaican middle classes, consists of a broad sweep of Jamaicans from different social classes and political persuasions. They intend to firstly march on the Jamaican government's King's House next Monday, demanding the resignation of the leader of the opposition JLP, Edward Siaga, then march again the following Monday to the government's Jamaica House building, where they'll demand the resignation of the Jamaican PNP Finance Minister, Dr. Omar Davies, and Minister for National Security and Justice, K.D. Knight. The call comes following a vote at the Citizens for Civil Society's last meeting, where members voted overwhelmingly in favour of these recommendations. A spokesperson for the pressure group cited the collapse of the country's economy, the high crime rate, and the lack of a viable opposition party due to fragmentation caused by poor leadership as the reasons for specifically targeting these politicians. Since its establishment last year, the pressure group has attracted up to 500 people at its last meeting, as well as gaining support through phone calls, faxes and emails from Jamaica's populace backing the group's actions. A large number of these supporters come from one of Jamaica's most powerful economic bases, returning residents who previously lived in Europe, America and Canada. They put forward the suggestion of withholding the payment of their taxes until something is done to improve what they see as the hopeless state of affairs in Jamaica. Currently, the Citizens for Civil Society's group's application for permission to march on King's House and Jamaica House has been rejected on the grounds that they had not agreed to the legal condition of stopping 200 yards short of the government buildings. A new application is currently being considered by the police. From Kingston, Jamaica, this is Karen Weir for BBC Caribbean Report.
And that's it for this evening's programme. I'm Debbie Ransom, saying goodbye from London.